It is Tuesday, January 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Turkish media issue video of a man they say was responsible for the Istanbul nightclub attack.
There's some reports saying that this is a 28-year-old from Kyrgyzstan.
President-elect Donald Trump condemns a recent statement by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on missile development, and a new film explores the life of a boy coping with his mother's terminal illness. It's all ahead. Turkish media broadcast a video of a man they say is the suspected gunman who killed 39 people during a New Year's attack on an Istanbul nightclub. The video appears to be from a cell phone the man is carrying as he walks around Istanbul's Taksim Square. It's unclear when the video was recorded. I spoke with reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul about the investigation.
Well, we're getting a lot of information from media, in fact, from state-run TV stations and pro-government media, but nothing formal from the state. And there's quite a lot of conflicting information. There's some reports saying that this is a 28-year-old from Kyrgyzstan. That came from the state broadcaster. Then there came information saying he was possibly from belonging to the Uyghur minority in China. But none of this has been confirmed. In fact, the identity was published of the gunman by, again, state media, but then that has since been retracted. So there's a lot of information going around, a lot of it's contradictory, but it does appear that this gunman did spend some time in the Turkish city of Konya. Now, that's a very conservative city. It's in the center of Turkey, and it is known as a base that's been used by Islamic State cells and jihadist groups for operations into Syria. And so there are no surprises there. There are reports that the wife of the gunman has been detained and questioned. But again, there's very little formal information coming out about this. We do understand there have been some more detentions. Two foreigners were detained at Istanbul Atatürk International Departure Lounge, but no more information about those. And there's been also a few other arrests. And it's believed mainly those that have been detained come from Central Asian countries of Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan.
What is the atmosphere like in Istanbul regarding this attack, and are people worried that there might be another one?
Well, indeed. I mean, I was out in the evening last night, and everything was very quiet, even though it is a couple of days after New Year's Eve. Even for that time of the year, exceptional. All the bars are empty, the coffee shops are broadly empty too. People are staying at home. And I think there is a genuine concern that this gunman, who is widely accepted, is a professional. He knew how to use his gun. He discharged his gun 160 times in the space of 7 minutes, killing 39 people. He could well strike again. It's unclear whether he's still in Istanbul or he has left the city, but there is fear, and there is fear that another terror attack could occur. Istanbul's still recovering from last month's bombing blamed on Kurdish rebel group that targeted a football stadium where police were on duty. This country is increasingly concerned that security forces are failing to come to grips and prevent these terror attacks.
That's interesting in light of the recent crackdown by the Turkish government following the coup. I mean, so many officials and journalists have been arrested.
Well, indeed, that is in some ways seen as part of the difficulties facing the security forces, because much of this crackdown and purge has been on the Turkish police and the wider security forces. Literally, thousands upon thousands of senior officers have been removed from the police, accused of being involved in the plot to overthrow the government. Similar wide-scale purges have gone on within the military, and experts say that this definitely will have an effect on the effectiveness of the security forces, in particular that much of the purges have affected the police's anti-terror units. And even though the government say that all these people have been replaced, analysts and experts say that it still will take time for those people to get up to speed, and this really puts them at a disadvantage. And at the same time, you have these twin threats. You have Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, targeting Turkey's main cities, mainly security forces, and you have Islamic State as well. Unprecedented levels of terror. At the same time, the security forces are struggling with these purges.
Dorian Jones reporting from Istanbul. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, we've got a series of tweets from Donald Trump, but what's the change? We've been talking about Donald Trump's tweets for months, but today, three tweets in particular from the president-elect sparking some conversation. The first coming about North Korea, and I know you're going to talk about that later in the show, but after North Korea announcing that they are finalizing a missile that could reach the U.S., President-elect Trump saying that it won't happen, and then taking aim at them about China, saying that China is supporting North Korea. So some strong words there. Then a tweet that he sent out about General Motors apparently sending Mexican-made models of their Chevy Cruze to U.S. car dealers tax-free, and proposing perhaps a border tax because of that. So as a result of that tweet, GM stock actually dropped by about 1%. So it actually had a financial ramification because of his tweet and his threat of a border tax, and could have a broader potential implication for businesses. That's one of the things he's talked about, is having businesses keep jobs and manufacturing in the U.S. and punishing those that move their business outside of the U.S. So we'll see if that continues. He's targeted now GM, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and others. So we'll see if that trend continues. And this third tweet is perhaps the most interesting. Now, a little bit of background. Yesterday, the House Republican Conference, the House of Representatives, voted to begin dismantling the Independent Office of Congressional Ethics. Well, Donald Trump didn't like that, and today he tweeted out and said, with all that Congress has to work on, do they really have to make the weakening of the Independent Ethics Watchdog as unfair as it is? Maybe their number one priority, focus on tax reform, healthcare, and so many other things of far greater importance. Now, after that tweet, which he sent earlier today, according to some news sources, the House Republicans have backed down on their plan to dismantle that ethics organization. So already, just in this first day of the 115th Congress, Donald Trump already having some influence on the effect of Congress, and through Twitter, no less.
Yeah, Twitter seems to be his favorite tool.
There's been some talk even among the press that there may be some bypassing of the White House press corps, of the traditional reporters, to reach out to people directly through Twitter. And I have no doubt that this is a medium he's going to continue to use throughout his presidency.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Some of the top news stories trending. Syrian rebel groups say there will be no talks until the Syrian regime stops violating the ceasefire. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump assails General Motors for making cars in Mexico. Israeli police open a criminal probe into Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And the 115th U.S. Congress is the most racially diverse. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory reports that two interesting objects from the outer solar system will be traveling through Earth's neighborhood, but should not come close enough to pose any threat. Spotted by NASA's NEOWISE project, the two objects include a comet and what may have once been a comet. NASA says with a good pair of binoculars, there's a good chance that the comet C2016U1 NEOWISE might be visible in the northern hemisphere's southeastern sky in the early morning hours during the first week of 2017. The second object, called 2016 WF9, is an asteroid that scientists say resembles a comet in several aspects, but lacks others that would define it as a comet. NASA says this object will approach Earth's orbit on February 25, 2017, but the closest it should get to us is about 51 million kilometers from Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, international students in the U.S. speculate how they might be affected by the incoming Trump administration. President-elect Donald Trump has taken to his Twitter account again. This time, he responded to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's New Year's address, in which he said his regime is in the final stages for a test of an intercontinental ballistic missile. Mr. Trump said whether such a missile could reach the United States, it won't happen. A South Korean foreign ministry spokesman said Tuesday the comment shows Mr. Trump is clearly aware of the gravity and urgency of the North Korean nuclear threat. The president-elect also took aim at China, tweeting it has been taking out massive amounts of money and wealth from the U.S. in totally one-sided trade, but won't help with North Korea. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said Tuesday China's hard work to ensure denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula should be obvious to all. Sun Yun Lee, an assistant professor of Korean studies at Tufts University in Boston, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, given the trajectory of Pyongyang's nuclear and missile programs, it's likely close to delivering a nuclear warhead on a missile that can hit the mainland U.S.
Rather than underestimating or patronizing North Korea, I would err on the side of caution and take Kim Jong-un's threat very seriously and really brace for an imminent, perhaps a very soon, such a missile test, a flight test of a ballistic missile. It could come even in January. January 8th is Kim Jong-un's birthday. Last year, we remember, he conducted his fourth nuclear test, the country's fourth nuclear test, just 2 days shy of his birthday on January 6th, and then followed up a month later with yet another long-range missile test. So that's a serious threat. And Mr. Trump probably took the right tone, but it's very unconvincing. I don't think the United States can really stop North Korea's machinations, North Korea's designs.
What kind of policy change is necessary?
We have at least a quarter century of documented failed policy, I would say. Going back to the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, the Clinton administration, George W. Bush administration, and the outgoing Obama administration. All conventional approach to North Korea negotiations with a bit of sanctions here and there, that has not worked. North Korea has marched down the nuclear path, and we are a lot worse off today than we were, say, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, certainly 25 years ago.
Sun Yung Lee said real pressure on North Korea would include restricting North Korea's ability to complete financial transactions and imposing sanctions on countries doing business with Pyongyang. Cedric Layton, an international risk assessment consultant and former Air Force intelligence officer, was asked if the Trump tweet represents a potential shift in U.S. policy.
It's not really a shift in U.S. policy so much as a much more vigorous explanation of U.S. policy. U.S. policy has basically called for a denuclearized Korea, and the only way to enforce that, of course, now that North Korea does possess nuclear weapons, is to make it very clear that the North Koreans can't deploy those weapons on an intercontinental ballistic missile. So it's a reaffirmation of U.S. policy in a very direct way for the new president.
Where does North Korea line up on the national security risks that the U.S. faces in 2017?
Very near the top. I think the North Koreans are clearly one of the top three threats that the United States and its partners face in the world. And certainly it is the number one threat in Asia. And there's no better way to put it than to say that it is one of the top concerns that the U.S. has. And it is also one of the top things on the agenda for any incoming president.
Cedric Layton said such an ICBM test could come sometime this year. Well, for the first time, the number of international students in the United States topped 1 million over the past year. But some educators and students say comments critical of China and other countries by President-elect Trump have the potential to affect international enrollment in U.S. universities and colleges. Mariama Diallo reports.
We're going to build the wall. It's going to be a real wall. It's going to be a great wall.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
The president-elect's campaign speeches on immigration and visas got a lot of attention from foreign students in the U.S. and international students thinking about attending U.S. colleges. Erica Wang is Chinese and one of 6,000 international students at the State University of New York at Buffalo.
I was still just looking to see, is he going to do whatever he promised? Or is his policy, potential policy change, possibly going to affect us? Because I have heard a lot of panicking right among my friends, definitely.
Via Skype, Stephen Dunnett, the university's vice provost, says campaign rhetoric can be different than actual government policy. However, Dunnett, who just returned from China, says the recent call between Trump and the leader of Taiwan had many in China talking.
The Chinese were quite taken aback by what appears to them to be the sudden abandonment of the one China policy. Some colleagues said to me, well, you know, this would come at a price. And there are an awful lot of our citizens studying in your universities. And, you know, that's a huge capital outflow from our country. And if you're not going to be welcoming to us, and maybe our students shouldn't go there.
Evelyn Levinson is the director of international admissions at American University. She says the admissions staff is reinforcing the school's message of tolerance to reassure potential applicants.
There is no crystal ball right now to say what will happen, but certainly a lot of questions were raised. So this fall, we went back out to cities in Europe. I personally was in the Middle East and in Central America, and someone else from our office was in Hong Kong and Singapore.
A recent study by the Institute for International Education says that China remains the top sending country, followed by India and Saudi Arabia. IIE President Alan Goodman says he doesn't think the election's outcome will affect international enrollment. For nearly 100 years, the Institute's data show no major changes, except for a two-year drop after the 9/11 attacks.
We've looked at this during periods when isolationism was the declared foreign policy of the United States. We have looked at it through periods of recession and depression. We've looked at it through periods of war and conflict.
He says because the country's higher education is run at the state level, federal policy matters less than what the individual schools do to reach out to students. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. A new film based on the acclaimed children's novel, A Monster Calls, opens this month. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the film tells the story of a boy coming to terms with his mother's terminal illness.
Connor O'Malley has been plagued by nightmares. The 13-year-old shy, artistic boy is also the victim of his school bully. At 7 minutes past midnight, Connor keeps hearing a voice call to him from his bedroom window, which overlooks a churchyard with a giant yew tree. One night, Connor meets a monster, a massive tangle of roots and branches in human form. The monster tells Connor that he summoned it, and it will help him by telling him three short stories. In return, Connor must tell stories of his own. As Connor and the monster continue to meet, almost always at 12:07 a.m., we learn that Connor's mother, played by Felicity Jones, has terminal cancer. Connor is forced to move in with his cold, emotionally detached grandmother, played by Sigourney Weaver. The monster's stories are intended to teach the boy about life, but they continue to have increasing consequences, including the smashing of his grandmother's living room and the attacking of his nemesis at school. Liam Neeson provides the voice of the monster.
I don't know if you've read the book by Patrick Ness. It's an extraordinary, it really is like a classic book. And it just, you know, you close over the last page and certainly with me, it just really gets you thinking about aspects of your life.
When Connor tells his own nightmare, he begins to confront his feelings about his mother's imminent death. The monster reveals that he has been sent to help Connor heal, and when the boy accepts his mother's terminal illness, she dies in the hospital at 7 minutes after midnight. Newcomer Lewis McDougall plays Connor.
I guess really I would use like experiences in my own life to try and understand what Connor's feeling, but you know, also there was the fact that I had to do an English accent, which I'm Scottish of course, and so I had to do a bit of dialect coaching for that, and I actually had a couple of weeks of rehearsals with everybody, including Liam, and so that was very helpful.
Neeson says that McDougall embodied the nuances and the emotions Connor experiences in a way not usually seen in child actors.
Terrific kid, and what a performance he gives. I mean, I've made quite a few movies with quite a few children. This boy is brilliant. He really is. It's a brilliant performance.
Sigourney Weaver says that she, director J.A. Bayona, and Felicity Jones did their homework to make sure that their performances were true to life.
You know, Felicity and I, and Bayona, we did meet with doctors in England, cancer specialists. We also went to hospice to see what the challenges of taking care of someone in the last stages of cancer would be. So we did kind of fill up on that, and I know she also met with women survivors of cancer.
A Monster Calls is based on the book by Patrick Ness, who also wrote the Chaos Walking series for children. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Throughout this holiday season, the United States government is profiling the cases of prisoners unjustly held around the world and the families they leave behind. The stories of these individuals, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power, highlight the broader struggle faced by so many families of political prisoners who have to commemorate countless family occasions with loved ones behind bars. One of those unjustly imprisoned is Ilham Toti, a member of the Muslim Uyghur ethnic group in China. Before his arrest, Ilham Toti was a distinguished professor of economics at Beijing's Minzu University. Toti was also a voice of reason on Uyghur issues, encouraging both the Chinese government and the Uyghur community to constructively engage in order to improve relations. Beginning in 2006, Toti ran a website to foster discussion about the economic, social, and developmental issues Uyghurs face. His site also improved cross-cultural understanding between ethnic groups by translating Chinese language news into Uyghur. In January 2014, Toti was arrested with seven of his students and accused by Chinese authorities of forming a criminal gang that sought to split Xinjiang from China. In September 2014, after a two-day trial, Toti was given a life sentence on charges of separatism. Toti's sentence is one of the harshest handed down to a rights activist in recent years and comes amid a sweeping crackdown on dissent under Chinese President Xi Jinping. Several of the students arrested with Toti were given lesser sentences after their televised public confessions. Toti was tried and imprisoned in Xinjiang, more than 2,000 kilometers from Beijing, where his family still lives, making it difficult and expensive for them to see him in brief bi-monthly visits. Mr. Toti and his family represent thousands of other prisoners unjustly detained around the world and their family members who also suffer as a result. The United States, said Ambassador Power, calls on all governments to release them. Political prisoners should be free to believe. They should be free to be loved. They should be free to be home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.